Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse. I almost forgot the meeting there for a second. This is your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our Sweet Ops community plus live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's December 11th, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Ostrom. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with Terraform, just head over to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions and you'll book a meeting with me directly. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format's real informal, so engage as much as you'd like, ask questions, and if you're curious about any of our open source tools like Atmos or modules, go for it. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse. And you'll find this recording from today's session there in a few hours. So let's get into those news and announcements. Like I said, to those who joined early, I am pretty light on material. I think AWS reInvent sucked all the oxygen out of the DevOps ecosphere. So this is all I was able to pick up. So if you have anything interesting, share it in the chat. All right. So first one was just something trend. It was just something I saw on Hacker News, which was kind of interesting. If you recall, it was a couple of months ago now, Redis announced they changed their license. And if you haven't looked into that whole Redis story, it is really interesting, really intriguing, because Redis, the company, has like they basically got Redis for free in the end. And then the original founder left Redis, and Redis changed their license, and that's when the next big fork happened with Valkey and many major cloud providers getting behind Valkey as the next generation of like a Redis alternative software. Well, Anti-Rez, who is the original creator of Redis, has been kind of staying out of it. He's chimed in here and there, and has and is kind of empathetic to both sides of this whole brouhaha, both the open source and the company behind Redis wanting to commercialize it and make some more money from it. And he reached out to them, seeing if he could join kind of as a community evangelist of some kind, and sounds like that was accepted. So he will probably be a little bit more present, and I'm not sure what this does. Create some confusion. It's not really like, but it's kind of like, imagine if Mitchell Hashimoto came back to HashiCorp and now represented day-to-day Terraform happening. Any thoughts on this? Anybody you've been following this closer? Next announcement was something also trending on Hacker News this week. Don't ask me why, but you can search for any UUID out there, and you can even star your favorite UUIDs now, because we always needed that. I don't know. The only use case I've seen so far is people hitting Command F so they can find vanity UUIDs for projects and examples. But I guess there's also something interesting about this implementation. I didn't go into it, but apparently it does something pretty fancy so that you can actually scroll through this and search for it very efficiently. And it's not going to crash your browser and things like that. And it has infinite scroll.
I don't know. I'm kind of confused by this thing. because it's, if my math is right, UUID 4, so UUID is 128 bits. UUID 4, I think, takes 6 bits for the whatever they call that thing, the version, and then the variant or whatever. Those are the two parts. So that leaves it being, what did I just say? So 122 bits, right? So the possible combination would be 2 to the 122 power. So that's like a 35-digit long number. That's how many possible combinations there are. Like, how did
So
they
he's using
generate
math
this?
deterministic. Yeah, he's using
Yeah.
math to deterministically show what are the pre immediately preceding UUIDs and the
Right,
system.
but how did they generate and store all of these? That's like a massive amount of data.
I think it's computed in the. I think it's probably entirely in the browser, and I think it's only computing. So it's starting, let's say, at 1, 2, 3, 4, and then translating that to the UUID on the right. And then if I search for something, Command F, like A is, I guess that's not valid, but here, there, and then it can calculate based on that position a certain number of UUIDs before and after. That's my assumption of how it's implemented as a layman.
Yeah, but doesn't that mean that they had to generate and store all of these somewhere to get the,
I
like,
guess,
what?
yeah, I guess since you, yeah, for the, yeah, since I'm searching the right side, not the left, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I
So
mean,
that's,
that's like a giant thing.
yeah.
I mean,
So.
to come up with that number, I mean, you can already see, like, that's whatever that undillion or some crazy level, I don't know. So I don't know. I didn't really see too much about this, but I was just wondering how, I was trying to do the math, like, while you were talking about it, to see if I could make it
Yeah,
work.
here's that
So
number.
yeah, so is that right? 35 digits. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So that's 37 digits, but that's regular UUID. That doesn't take off the, yeah. Okay, so here's the. Okay, so I guess it explains, like, how they
Yeah,
do it,
I'll
I
share the
guess. And
algorithm for those that are
yeah.
curious how he was able to solve it. That's what the whole Hacker News crowd kind of dove to, was
Yeah.
how he actually implemented it.
The maximum scroll position in the browser. That's nuts. That's a lot of data.
Lost my Zoom chat now. Oh, there it is. It was camouflaged. There's that link on that right up on it.
Yeah,
All right.
I always geek out on, like, algorithms like this, so I have to figure out how they did that.
All right. Another minor announcement from GitHub was, they've been slowly investing in better observability around GitHub Actions and runners, and now you can actually understand runner labels and how much they're used. So presumably, if you have a lot of discrete kind of runner pools configured with runner labels, now you can see which ones are actually being used and if they're saturated or not. And failure rates and things.
I'm curious, just, sorry, I didn't get to read that metric quickly enough. Is there an average queue time on that?
Average runtime,
Oh, there it
average
is,
queue time,
queue
there it
time.
is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
Okay.
that's obviously the most important part for
Yeah.
you. Like, you know, if you're, well, assuming that that's what you're trying to optimize for, is that people don't sit around and wait for jobs to run. Like, that seems like it would be pretty important. So.
Yeah, I agree. That'd be great. I'd be really curious to see that. Comparing that with like Arc Actions Runner Controller with runs on and seeing the difference there.
Yeah, and then there's the other one that I found the other day. I can't remember the
Yeah.
name of that also claims to be
Runzon has a monopoly on the best domain name. Hard to forget it.
Yeah.
Okay, next announcement. Something I didn't know was possible were more native app integrations with the ChatGPT desktop app. Now, it's not amazing. It's kind of like how in VS Code and Copilot, you can select some code and then tell and then chat with ChatGPT around it. This kind of lets you do that, but with native desktop apps in the ChatGPT app. And then there's a integration with that and VS Code. And I wasn't searching this out, I just stumbled across it. So I haven't yet tried it out. I want to see what it's like. Has anybody tried this or is using it?
Do you know how that thing works? Is it like Apple script or something under the hood?
I don't. Yeah. OpenAI Chat GPT. Oh, that's the.
Oh, that's just the extension. I mean the actual like whatever that thing was called works with apps or whatever. How does that actually work?
It's kind of cool that you can integrate it with your terminal, though. So if you're having some, commit syntax errors, or you're working through JQ, it can actually then see the errors you're getting back from JQ, trying to get your filter right.
Yeah, for that's pretty much what Warp does for you, but it's not using ChatGPT. It has its own AI model basically built into it.
That's what you're using. Oh, last week, who was it that was talking about Cursor a lot? I thought it was last week or was it the week before? You weren't able to make that call. So.
Was it the internal call with me?
Oh, was it an internal call with you?
Yeah, we were
Okay.
just talking about it on Friday.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I don't think I missed an office hours, but that's why I was like, did
Yeah.
I? My brain was racking, like, where was I?
Yeah. Dan, does it make sense to bring it up? Was I forget if it had a it didn't have anything proprietary in that conversation, right? You.
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, it was just. We were just impressed by Cursor again, just the ability to ask very pointed questions about a code base that you're not familiar with at all, and for it to be able to point out the exact file that you should be editing.
That's what it
Pretty neat.
was. There's some team members that are less familiar with like the Atmos code base and wanted to get more involved. Dan did a test just to see if Cursor could make that easier. So he asked like a generic question like where would I introduce this functionality asking Cursor, and it pointed out prob the files that you would change to do that. So pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
sorry, go.
Well, that's just the beginning because you can ask where, and then you can ask how, and then you can tell it to do it for you. So you can just keep prompting it all the way through and just review it along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually just going to say that Cursor is like a plug it, like I don't know what you want to call it. It's kind of like an overarching framework, basically like a browser, but it has its own like framework to plug in various different models. So you can actually ask the same question to different models and get like better results depending on what you're asking and what kind of code bases you're working with and a bunch of what kind of functions you're writing, et cetera. So it works pretty well, to be able to switch among all of those things.
Mikhail mentions the Clang or C line VS Code extension. What does interesting. There's one of the frustrations I've had with Copilot, and I don't think this has changed yet, right? That it or Actually, I guess that is what it has changed now. You can tell Copilot to train on a number of repositories. I haven't tried doing that at Cloud Posse, but does that mean that one can do similar things with Microsoft's Copilot now?
I think only in like the enterprise version of it or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. You can because you enable it in GitHub Enterprise basically, and then you can tell it in there to train on different repositories that you have within your org.
That's interesting. All right. Anything you wanted to add to this, Mikhail, on Klein? All right. Next topic was, I'm sure many of you seen this if you're in SweetOps Slack. It's been discussed and commented on. So the tag Ubuntu latest is moving from Ubuntu 22 to Ubuntu 24, happening, well, starting on December 5th. So if you've started encountering problems, that might be why. One of those that Jenkins, Michael Jenkins was talking about was that Ubuntu 22 had open source Terraform in it, and 24 removes it since it's now BSL. You probably shouldn't have been and are not using it, but if you were, now is a good time to swap that out with a GitHub Action that installs OpenTofu instead. Also, if you haven't checked what version of the Actions cache you're using, or artifacts, the V3 is going away. And they're going to start a brownout soon, so you'll notice if that is affecting you or not. Another exciting announcement is that immutable actions will be imminent, and these were supposed to already be released, and then it got pushed out to end of next year, and now it's back to like Q1 of next year now. And it's basically going to work using GitHub packages. So the heads up here is that once that rolls out, if you are doing any kind of firewalling, you're going to want to make sure that you permit requests to this endpoint and this endpoint, in addition to obviously the GitHub container registry.
Yeah, which is all well and good, except for like by whitelisting that, you're basically whitelisting everyone that in the entire universe worth of GitHub, which doesn't seem like the best way. It would be nice if you could somehow restrict that to certain repos or whatever.
Well, I think you can, but it's a good comment. They should point out those distinctions. But on GitHub, you can, or at least on GitHub Enterprise, you can specify which actions or orgs for actions you allow.
But not which, I guess maybe, I guess that's true if you do that, but you can't then just whitelist a certain package repository, right? Like you have to actually whitelist the action
Good
itself.
question. It's a good question. But package repositories are associated with a Git repository. They don't exist independent of that. So I believe the current implementation as it is, where you specify the GitHub repository as being allowed, is how that would work. What I thought you were going to say was a way to create blessed versions, kind of the of actions that you allow, but I don't
Yeah.
know if that's pop. I don't know if you can specify tags basically on allowed versions or not.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the other thing I was specifically reacting to was like if you had blocked from a network level perspective, if you had blocked access, like you have your runners in some sort of that like isolated place. Now you basically need to open up your runners to all of GitHub. Like basically that's what it's saying. Like anyone and anywhere. Like If you see, you have to what like from a network level, you scroll down, it actually says you have to whitelist like GHCR.com, and here's the IP address lists you should use, which is basically like every place that they have public, GHCR endpoints, I guess.
That reminds me, there was something else I'd seen recently when I was looking at the Cloud Posse settings. Were repository policies, and it says it's in preview, so I guess this is something new. So we've talked about previously repository rule sets, which are really powerful. I love the implementation. You can create basically a lot of named policies that apply to certain named policies that apply to certain repositories in your organization. They allow certain GitHub apps to maybe bypass those rules. They allow you to enforce tagging conventions and enforcing tag immutability and all of that, which is great. Now there is forthcoming policies on repositories, which are similar, and it's interesting because you can enforce names. I think what one could do is add a target here. So if any repository matches like Terraform, then have a naming pattern where it must be, and this is a regex, where it must begin with Terraform dash, dot star question mark dash, which is the provider, and then something else. So I thought that was kind of cool. It could be a way to enforce that. Now, this is obviously only triggering when it already had the word Terraform in there somehow. So maybe it's a little bit less useful. I think one can do by property. So one of the cool things you can do in GitHub is define your own, in GitHub Enterprise at least, you can define your own custom properties. And when you clone a template repo, and if those properties are not set, it will prompt you to ask, it'll prompt you to fill in those custom properties that aren't defaulted. One of those can be, what type of project is this? And you select from a predefined list, Terraform, GitHub Action, Java project, JavaScript, or something else. So then if you take that logic combined with repository policies like this, you could probably then enforce a naming convention now on that type of project. So kind of cool that GitHub is investing in some of these more enterprise-y features.
Still no
And
folders.
yeah, still no folders, man. Ba-da-ching. All I want is folders. Give me folders. And I'll be happy for this year. It's so frustrating. I don't get it why it's such a hard. Why? There's just got to be some really senior person or group of people at GitHub that are able to veto any proposal for folders on GitHub or something.
It's probably because every convention right now is slash org slash repo slash folder within the repo, and now you can op you'll optionally be messing with that whole thing, like every library that works with Git, and every possible thing that's out there. It's like massive, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It could be something like that. And the last announcement, I don't recall if we brought it up on office hours. It came out in the last 2 weeks, was a new feature in Atmos. So I thought I'd bring it up again. Even if we had talked about it, it's good to surface these things so everyone's aware. So in Atmos for a long time, in template configurations, we've supported functions. So all the Sprig functions, all the Gauntlet functions, all the standard Go template functions. And that's nice. It's convenient. One of the cool things is that it gives you full cap full, the full ability to customize any of the values using Go templates here. I wouldn't say this is a beautiful syntax. It's not bad. But some of the same problems arise that when you work with templating in other tools like Helm as well that uses it, a Helm file that uses it. Is working with YAML and templates is messy business because YAML, like Python, is sensitive to white space and how it's formatted. And if you're doing some templating here and retrieving a value that returns a list or a map, you need to handle that situation. Further complicating things is using squiggly braces at the beginning of values in YAML. YAML parsers will interpret this as a inline JSON object and then complain that it's an invalid JSON object. All right, so that's why we are changing our approach. In Atmos moving forward, we're not going to remove any of the templating stuff, and it's super valuable, and we'll continue to support that. But we want to invest more in things that are native to YAML. And there's a lot of interesting things with YAML when you look under the hood and what you can do. Things that, we didn't think of using in the beginning when we implemented all of these things. One of those things is that YAML supports this concept of explicit types, and there are three types of explicit types. You got the core types that are built into YAML. You got some defined types for like binary data. I'm not exactly sure which was, this one refers to. And then you have user defined. So user defined types are ways that you can extend YAML in your implementation in a way that conforms to the YAML spec. And if you've ever seen in, a bang, or like, I guess the built-in ones are usually two bangs. So it'd be like bang bang str is a way to cast some string to a string in YAML, or bang bang bool casts like some value to a Boolean and so forth. Well, we're introducing our own. Here are three to start with, and we're going to be adding lots more to this as well. The first one is template, and this gets around a big problem that we had in Atmos using some of the functions, the template functions that return complex objects like maps and lists and things like that. They weren't properly getting injected into the YAML configuration. So now, if you just prefix your template with a bang template, we are casting this to a template, and then this will return and inject the proper value into the YAML document. So we have an example of that. Well, we have an example of an alternative workaround, which we've been telling people to use for a while, which was changing the delimiters for Go templates, but now you can just use the template function. So here's what that looks like. So we're saying here we're using a Go template function to retrieve the outputs of some component, and the output here is test list, which is a list. And then because we have this here, Atmos is going to know to convert this to a native list when it's returned. And same thing here. It's going to interpret basically the JSON and inject that in. We have a new function for exec, which wasn't supported before in any way. So if you have some custom command that will produce a JSON response and you want to be able to inject that into your configuration, now you can do that with exec. And just like we had atmos.component before, now we have terraform.output, which is just a native way of doing this using the explicit types. So yeah, this is equivalent now to this. So it's just a simpler syntax there. It's a little bit more efficient. All right, any questions on that? I think that's the end of my announcements.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, just for clarification of your, when you're talking about YAML at the beginning, the double bang is a forced typecasting to that type that you're double banging, and the other one is basically like the other one is just asserting that it is that type so that the parser that is parsing the YAML can actually do something based on that type assertion, like where any parser has to support the double bang type casting of that value basically to be YAML compliant. And then not every YAML parser will understand what to do with single bangs. It's just a type hint basically, rather than a forced coercion or forced casting, excuse me, of the type to that value, or to of the value to that type.
Okay. All right, let's go to Q&A. Chat. I think there was a question in the Sweet Ops Slack, so let me look at that quickly.
That was really confusing because it
Yeah.
said launching Open Tofu. I was like, what? But it
Yeah,
was actually launching the Open Tofu Slack.
I think I had a different session there. So rather than log in, I'm just going to read the question in the regular Slack here. Sweet ops office hours. All right, let's see here. So Josh Simmons asks,
You're not
Matt Schmidt.
sharing that
Yeah.
part of your screen.
That was because I'm not in the browser anymore. Let me see if I can share. So two questions. Matt Schmidt, I guess, first asks, would like to discuss remote state as discussed in brownfield considerations. And Josh Simmons separately has a question regarding the migration from AWS components repo to the new GitHub org. Currently, the reference modules within AWS components repo are not only denying PRs and auto but also aren't referencing the new component locations. So yeah, let me address this one first, since this is a very easy one to address. A few things. So if you go to this repo, we have a full mapping. So this is the new organization. If you go to Cloud Posse and the old repo, Terraform AWS components, and you spell it the right way. Oh, you don't see my browser. So, okay, let me stop sharing. Okay, hold on. There. And let me fix the spelling here. Terraform AWS com. Components. We have the README, the landing page of this repository shows the exact mapping between the old component and the new component. So that's option one. Option two is if we go to the issue that we created for this, there's also some additional information. And we have updated the component updater to rewrite all those sources for you automatically. So if you're using the Cloud Posse's component updater, that's the easiest way to go about it. We've also documented at docs.cloudposse.com. If you go to reference components here, we talk about it. And there's a migration guide here I'll share, which is the manual kind of migration guide if you want to do it that way. I think it also talks about the component updater as well, and how you can use that. So to use the component updater, you're going to want to make sure you use the latest version, which is 2.8.0. We've used this with customers already, and it's working well. Another nice thing that we've done in the update to the component updater is now it supports signed GitHub commits. So if you require code signing, now the component updater works nicely together with that. So I'll share that as well here. And I'll share that with you that I was talking about a second ago. So we are, as was pointed out, we are automatically closing any pull requests to this component repo. We are doing that so that there's no divergence. In extreme cases, if there's a vulnerability or something we gotta roll out to the old org, we can still do that. We have a bypass for that. But any general pull requests will automatically get closed like this with a message about this linking to the issue and how to upgrade and everything. Any questions on this?
So the prescriptive guidance here would be to try to run the component updater, and that should automatically update the if you're vendoring the modules from you guys, then that would handle
Exactly.
updating those URLs. How does that account for the fact that the Terraform AWS components repo effectively has wrapper modules around the actual component, like the other sub modules that you call? Does that change the syntax of the calls, and then we have to go through a reconciliation of the resources, or are those carried over too?
As part of this migration, we deliberately wanted the first, well, like we wanted to copy verbatim every commit over, so there were no changes as a result of that. So basically, if you were on version 1.2.3 over here, and you point to 1.2.3 over here, it should just work. Obviously, if you're pinning to commit SHAs, it won't work because we could not preserve those. But we did preserve committer history, and we linked to the originating PR in the other repository. And the other repository won't be getting deleted. We're going to keep that around. Worst case, at some point, we archive it, but it's never going away. And then to your point here, there have been cases where I'll say unfortunately, we have some components that refer to a module in like dot using relative paths or dot dot slash or things like that. I think that's what you're getting to. That affects not that component itself so much as it affects how or where you vendor it to. And because this change doesn't affect where you vendor it to, it doesn't affect you in that case. And what the component updater is doing is just changing the source of that component and rewriting that in the pull request. And it's not directly committing to main or anything. It's opening a pull request for that, just the way that like component updater works. So you can review that pull request and even edit it if you need to or something as part of that migration.
Okay, cool. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, sure thing, Josh. And please reach out. You know, it's early enough in the process. It's great if there's anything you encounter that's a problem, let us know because we want to know. You won't be the only one affected. And you know, the reason we are doing this is, of course, so that we can add automated tests. So that's the thing that we're starting to work on now, is adding Terra tests to all of that. With Matt Calhoun's help here, we wrote a Terra test helper that lets us test an Atmos stack in dependency order, and that's how we're going to now be able to accept more pull requests to our components, like we do our Terraform modules. The big picture, long-term goal I hope we achieve next year is that we can take a very advanced stack, like an entire account architecture, and bring it up and tear it down in dependency order and validate that for every change to the components therein. So I consider that kind of like the holy grail of automated infrastructure testing, and that's what we're aiming for. All right. Then there was a question on brownfield. Let's see, who asked that question?
I'm here and hanging out. Love
Hey,
to give you a
Matt.
good maybe overview of it. It's funny enough, it actually I think maybe has to deal with that bang terraform.output feature that's you were talking about
Oh,
earlier.
could be.
Yeah.
If you are having a specific problem there, we are a little bit limited in what we want to do, like in terms of debugging or triaging on office hours, just since we want to appeal to the broadest audience. But if there's a technical issue you run into, definitely post it in the Atmos channel on the SuiteOps Slack. If you can show kind of any error messages or things you're getting, that's going to be the best way of going about it. But otherwise, conceptually, definitely can help you answer any questions around brownfield or high level. Yeah, if you're seeing some problems like with the parsing related to any template notation, that's almost always one of two reasons. One, templating is not enabled, and in Atmos right now, we have it disabled by default. I think I'll open up an ARP topic internally and see if we just turn that on by default now. We always considered it an advanced escape hatch feature, but it turns out to be the thing that everyone wants to use the most of. So I think we should just like accept that's the reality. And then two is maybe what you're talking about, like needing the bang template so that it properly decodes it and interprets it as JSON and not something else.
Yeah, for this one, the bang terraform output, I'm trying to use it with the
Oh,
remote
sure.
state static. And I'm wondering if this is a scenario it's kind of meant to be used for. So I get to basically we've thought about this and we would like to use some of like the reference architecture modules, but some of them we can't use, like DNS delegated right now. So what we'd like to basically do is kind of mock that out and say, all right, let's put the outputs we
No.
know and
Oh, okay.
try to inherit them down.
I got you 100%. All
Yeah.
right. I
What's
think
wrong
I
with
did. Let me
DNS
say.
delegated?
Well, let me start over here though. But just level set so everybody is on the same page here. So, what he is talking about is this new function we were just introducing a few minutes ago, which was. Under configure stacks, YAML functions, and the new function here, Terraform output. Terraform output is designed to retrieve the outputs of a Terraform component, having run the command Terraform output on that component. You are now referring to something else that we talk about, and I can see the conundrum here and the confusion. So we have this concept shared data between components where's the static backend?
It's right there using Terraform remote state on the right-hand side. Right, all the way to the right.
Okay.
I think
Yeah, well, so this
that's
is
that.
using the module. And so yeah, to Matt, I mean, so the way this works is if you use this syntax, that static backend you define will work fine. But that's in Terraform. And because the static backend that you're talking about is not related to an actual Terraform component, we can't run Terraform outputs on it. All of that said, Honestly, I think this is just an oversight. You know, we do a lot. We almost never, as a company, Cloud Pasta, we almost never do brownfield. So we don't get to test a lot of that stuff. And a lot of the stuff that we have for brownfield comes from people like you doing it and then telling us how they solved it or telling us there's a problem. So in this case, I don't see why we wouldn't maybe be able to, I'd have to talk to Andre and you know Matt and others if we couldn't make Terraform outputs. The syntax is basically the same. It should basically, if we see a static backend for that, we should probably be able to use it. But I'm not 100% sure on that without talking to them. Matt, do you
Got
understand the problem?
it. I think
Yeah.
so. Kind of different spaces, right?
Oh,
Oh, we're
sorry.
both Matts. Hey, Matt.
Oh, sorry.
How you
Yeah,
doing?
you got to be context aware when you talk to
Yes.
Go ahead, Matt.
No, I was only going to say that really quickly that maybe there's no reason to have this as a back end at all and just have it as like some sort of stack configuration where you can pass those values in and the static values that you need are not using remote state through Terraform. Well, I guess if they're using, I guess you're right. I understand your point though, because you're using other reference architecture modules that require to be able to look things up in the remote state. So forget what I was going to say there, but I think it's worth noting that one of the things that we're sort of iterating on to be able to get there with like all these testing things we're doing and breaking things apart and doing all that is so that we can decouple a lot of these assumptions and ways of getting data, sort of apart so that we can do more brownfield deployments. But I know that doesn't help you on, whatever it is, December 11th, 2024, to do that today, but it is something we're looking at for the future.
So we moved all the components from the monorepo to the polyrepo so we can version them with proper Semver so that we can now start releasing breaking changes to components with new major releases so that we can do the decoupling Matt's talking about so we can support you and what you're trying to do there without relying on strictly on remote state. Remote state seemed awesome at the time. I thought it was magical how we were doing it, seemed really good. And then we've kind of come full circle on that and realized we were wrong in doing it that way. And so
So
that's
got it.
what are you trying to do with DNS delegated? That's problematic.
Actually, nothing. We just ended up doing our own kind of DNS management with our own module. But stepping further down the reference architecture, we'd still like to pull some of those in. Since we don't use DNS delegated today, we're like, what if we could mock it out and possibly adopt it in the future? This remote state static seemed like a good way to kind of do that, where in the future we'd go down the line and say, awesome, let's plug in the DNS delegated today.
Yeah, in our specific use case, so Matt and I are on the same team.
Oh,
In our specific use case, when we try to adopt some of the modules from either the Terraform AWS components or the sub components now in the new direct in the new GitHub org, some of those make calls to DNS delegated, and because we don't have DNS delegated set up, we have to kind of go through a lot of hacky working around to try to make it. To try to make those pieces fit together. And so far, we haven't been successful. And I had kind of posted a question about this a while ago in the Atlas channel. And Andre had said that the remote state backend piece was intended to be sort of this mock area where you can effectively describe the outputs that you expect without ever actually invoking the module itself. And so that's what we've been trying and experimenting with, and we haven't been able to do it. None of the it just sort of fails to find. It's like it almost seems like the functionality isn't totally working, but we were just kind of hoping to find out any guidance that you guys had on how to actually implement that remote state backend static component or customization so that we could try continuing to move forward with that with this path that we're on, or if we have to sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater and just kind of Like our next thought was, let's just make our own DNS delegated module that just has outputs, and then and like there we have it, right?
Yeah, not the worst idea, honestly. But the remote state, I'm the maybe the problem we're having with remote state is that you're not setting the stack name properly for the remote state. The the remote the static remote state is going to still need to have all of the tenant environment stage variable set to indicate which stack it belongs to. And if it can't find it, that might be why.
Yeah, so in our and we don't have to rabbit hole on this, Eric. I know you were interested in sort of keeping it a little more high level. So if this is too deep, please feel free to stop me.
Let's we'll finish answering here, but then let's transition the if you can share the configs that aren't sensitive in the Atmos Slack channel, that'll give us a lot of context, and we'll help you get this figured out.
And let me just add one thing for sure. Like, so I can definitely confirm for you that the static backend does work because that's actually how we're doing a lot of our unit test mocking things that
Oh, nice.
we said that we're moving to for doing all these test things. That's actually what we used to be able to do that. So definitely works. It's probably just something in the config, and hopefully if you post that, we can help you out with what's missing from the config to make it work.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
We'll try to give you a very simple example.